Hello, this is UX Booster, a podcast about user experience design and skills development. Grow your confidence, learn how to design things that work, and get inspired. My name is Wojtek Kutyla, and I hope you'll enjoy the show. I have a bit of a funny history with Jamie Levy. We've met at UX Scotland few good years ago and became instant friends. I remember her amazing workshop that she's given on the occasion of her first book coming out, The UX Strategy, which I found to be incredibly influential not only in my practice, but generally on the UX world. When I learned that the second edition of the book is out, I had to speak to Jamie, especially I haven't seen her for a long time. She now lives in Berlin and I'm in Edinburgh. We are both working on many projects at the same time, and it was a good opportunity to speak to a friend who I've lost contact with for a number of years. Here's our chat, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, Jamie. Nice to see you.
Hi, Wojtek. So awesome to see you.
Right. We're going to talk about your book today, Jamie, and your experience of UX strategy and the work that you do in training and whatnot. Can you tell me what's been happening since then? Like, what happened since the UX strategy was released, the last edition of it?
Life happened for sure. Unexpectedly, when I wrote the first book, was that the book did really well. It did well just as a subject that people were really interested in the topic of UX strategy. And, you know, it was a bestseller, or is it still a bestseller, for O'Reilly, which basically translates to about 20,000 copies. So we're not talking Harry Potter, but that's a lot for tech. And what it really did, which was the unexpected gift, was really open, I got to go tour all over, the five continents and 30 countries and meet people like you that ultimately had a profound effect on my life. And then along that way, and doing workshops and meeting other experts who would give me feedback. And I tracked everything in a big document in case I decided to go crazy and write a second edition. And so, after 5 years, I was able to dip into that Google Doc. But yeah, the big thing is just me really getting to kind of have a second pass at having people appreciate my work and getting to have something to promote that I'm really proud of.
So you had this big, long list of notes and ideas, and how easy was it to turn it into the second edition this time? I remember when you were writing the first one, you said that it was a long and difficult process. Did you feel the same way this time?
It was very different this time. I think I attacked it in the same way as the first book, where I said I'm going to quarantine and lock myself into, don't want to use that word quarantine the wrong way. I wanted to lock myself into a library again, like I did with the first book, but it was a different library. It was one here in Berlin versus the Caltech in Pasadena. It was, so I was going down that lonely road of writing alone, and you hit walls when you're writing. Like, do I know enough about this term in this sentence to definitively say this? Because when you get to rewrite, you get to really revisit every single line and say, is this what I believe truly? And so because of COVID and me not being able to go into the libraries, I was forced to write at home. And that's, for writers, that's sometimes the last place they want to write, because it's almost more fun to, do the laundry than write. And so that's when I brought in a student of mine from the University of Southern California, and we would meet 4 hours a day, whether I was in LA or Berlin, and in a shared Google Doc. And whenever I would hit that little wall, she would go off and find the answer, and I could continue forward. And it made collaborative writing, editing, and researching is fun.
So Jessica, because that's her name, became your sort of researcher, helper, and also like motivator, slapping you from time to time. Hey, do some more work, right?
Yeah, as it says in the book, she was my muse. To have somebody, she was like half my age, right? She was like 24 and 55, so I guess that's more than half, right? And she's insanely smart and insanely quick and funny and sarcastic. So after a while, I started recording these sessions and putting them up on YouTube to just kind of pre-promote the book, but also just to have them to expose what it's like to write a book for people that are like, hey, I think I want to write a book. That sounds like a great idea. And they can see, you know, really what it's like, and especially a UX book. So it was a really interesting process, and I'm really excited and feel confident about the second book versus the first book, because it was so well researched. Everything was just like, let's make sure, you know, if we had something in there, like, did we describe the hook model right? I would just select it and share it with Nariel and have him address it, you know, and then he would edit it and make it his, and I'd be like, okay, whatever. And then I don't necessarily didn't want that major of an edit, but it was like, and then I'd send something to, whether it was Steve Blank or Lex Roman, like everybody was jumping in the Google Doc, and it was kind of a blast, you know, and to write it during COVID, it gave me something really social and fun to do.
Certainly the book does read and does seem to be much better researched. I mean, the first one, you know, was really vibrant, energetic, but I could also sense that it was more of a, like, you know, your version of doing this, you know, this is how I do it. Whereas here you have it more balanced, and that shows. So that's excellent. So well done on that. And let's talk about the UX strategy as such for a little bit. And I just wonder, you know, it's been so many years. How did it change during that time? You make some notes on this in the book, but I would like to hear it from you. What are the major changes that happened to our industry and to the way you work?
Right. So as I talk about, we wrote the first chapter last, you know, because we were just like, let's just see where things are at the very end with the term as I notice the change, because I've had a Google alert for UX strategy and for user experience strategy for about 10 years, ever since I was interested in it. I wanted to see anything that pops up on the internet, I want to read it. And 99% of the time, it was people using UX strategy or user experience strategy to describe a new role at their company, their organization, and they wanted to hire someone to evangelize UX and to help them develop a cohesive strategy to, you know, convince stakeholders of the ROI of UX. And it was really UX strategy with a small s, you know, and then also tons of people started calling themselves UX strategists, but they were using that as a way to go from UX design to UX strategy so they could take a more strategic role and more commonly be involved with product, to be working kind of almost as a product owner. And, you know, product owners were interested in UX strategy. And then comes this thing where people started saying, I'm not a UX designer, I'm a product designer. Right. And so it was like kind of obvious, like if you're a product designer, you don't want to become a UX strategist. You want to become a product strategist. And so even though in the first book I said product strategy, I think of really for more of offline products, for physical products. But now product strategy is a real thing. And I think the easiest way to bifurcate is to say, you know, if I had to, I think you can use the terms interchangeably, UX strategy and product strategy. But if I had to, you know, pick a lane, I'd say, well, I'm a product strategist because I'm obsessed with product and de-risking value propositions. And UX strategy tends to be more about process. And while that's really important, you know, as a consultant, you know, I would go with product strategy myself. So I call the book now UX strategy, product strategy techniques for devising innovative products. Fuck you, you know?
Yeah. So we have best of both worlds, right? yeah. No, you've touched on something that I can strongly feel when I'm reading your book, that, you know, that part of, as you said, de-risking, you know, initial value proposition is probably the most important aspect of it. And it just shines through. Like, you basically want to give, you know, organizations a tool to get rid of their stupid ideas and to validate the good ones, right? And so that experimental mindset that you talk about in the book is very important here. And I want you to talk a little bit about those experiments and the value of experimentation in approaching, you know, the risk analysis of a potential value of a new product, because that's something that I still think goes so outside of you know, so away, so far away from many comfort zones of many organizations that we work with. You know, how does it really work in practice? Because, you know, what's written in the book is great, but, you know, when the push comes to shove, when you really are doing it with an organization, do you find that this is sometimes problematic, that this is difficult for organizations to go through?
It really depends on that organization, you know, because they all have their own different cultures and different ways of, you know, whether they're flat or hierarchical. And, you know, I profile Volkswagen in the book, and they have a division called the Innovative Business Solution Studio, and it's run by now my friend Sebastian Philip. You know, I met him at a conference here in Berlin, and they are running experiments all the time. And if Volkswagen, if Valve can do it, I would think a lot of other organizations can too. It's not an original concept. Obviously, Clayton Christensen, you know, has been talking about, you know, having an experimental mindset when he was talking about disruptive innovation. And that, you know, for a lot of people, that can sound super buzzwordy and hand wavy. But with Lean Startup and that whole movement, and Eric Ries really saying, hey, this isn't just about startups, that we need to be conducting experiments and seeing our product, you know, discovery phases as the real time that we need to be running experiments on. He didn't necessarily say what his build, measure, learn feedback loop, what that it to me, it's a product strategy roadmap. You know, it's like, you know, build an initial value prop, measure, you know, a rapid prototype or a landing page, or through user research, validate, you know, build, measure, learn. And so I think he pivoted quite hard into enterprise, and so did a lot of other thought leaders who were from the lean world, because there's more money and it's just bigger. And it's also more challenging that, you know, with a startup, you can share, we're going to run experiments because there's less people in the workforce at risk. But when you have a large company, you need to truly build it into the organization, which was probably what got me so interested in the topic of digital transformation, because it's all about really looking at an organization and saying, well, why are they not being innovative? And then it gets truly into that they need to think about who are the people working there? What are their ways of working? And how can we optimize things so that people aren't afraid to conduct experiments and learn and take risks? So it's a culture of risk-taking that needs to be really accepted at these large companies.
I think so too. And I'm curious to see, you know, whether anyone's going to adapt this entire, you know, approach to strategy that you kind of advocate, or at least parts of it, to public sector organizations, because this is, you know, I deal with them a lot, and public bodies are, they tend to, you know, have like over bloated structures, and, you know, any sort of risk thinking in any way, thinking of any kind of risk is actually almost like, you know, that's just no, you don't go there, you know, and processes take so long, and it's just, you know, painful. So reading that book, you know, I noticed that most examples that you refer to are either from the startup domain or, you know, like a commercial world domain. I wonder whether you've been even thinking of, like, you know, how to adapt this to a public sector organization. You know, have you ever thought of this?
Not as much as I did for the second book. In terms of the goal with the second book was to focus on enterprise, whether it's B2B or B2C. But that was the big change. Was the first one was focused on startups, and the second one on enterprise, or at least mid-sized companies that already had product market fit. And, you know, but I still believe, and I know this from working with some B2Gs or whatever they're called, is that, you know, when you do competitive research, just because it's for the public sector, you may not see, like someone that told me that worked for the government that was using my book. He said, we don't see what you would consider the competitors as actual competitors, because they're partners, they're other government agencies, but we still research them as competitors. And it's the same process, because they want to see, you know, what's the market space like, who's doing something cool. So I feel like, you know, for competitive research, it still holds true. For value prop, for doing customer interviews, that technique still holds true. For creating rapid prototypes and putting them in front of users and getting feedback, it still holds true. The only thing that's really different is the business model.
That's true. And that it might be interesting to see, you know, adaptations of your book into practice in those domains. Maybe who knows, maybe I'll try. Maybe I'll have that luck.
You should do that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, using elements of it, you know, obviously I've been doing it for the last 3 years and certainly it's easy to adapt, but like that's the way I think that this should be approached in general. You know, it's not like a magic pill. Like, even say this in the book, I think that this isn't something that somebody should just take like this and, you know, treat it like this is a gospel and because Jamie Levy did it. You know, I believe that this is a set of methods that we can play with. You know, it's something that we can utilize to our own advantage. You know, choosing things that work for us, that's the best part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the most important thing is that people take their head out of the sand and look around and really become domain experts before they start doing design. I still can't believe it that people just, you know, design in a vacuum. They don't bother to look at other products that they're competing with to really look and see, you know, because there's a nascent markets often. And I think it's that same kind of, you know, little baby childlike behavior where they don't want to know, you know, like what's going on because it'll just make them anxious. But to me, it's like to know what you don't know, you know, it's like you can save yourself a lot of time in the end because you're going to get your product out in the marketplace and you're going to find out if it's a copycat or it doesn't live up to the other solutions.
Absolutely. There's one kind of final thing I wanted to touch on, which you know, which I find particularly important in those times. And you made some little kind of comments on it in the book, and I'm very happy about that. And it's to do with design ethics and, you know, things that are associated with obviously the trouble of our industry. You know, large organizations working well, maybe mostly for themselves rather than, you know, in any way supporting the interest of a citizen. And I wonder, you know, we have four tenets in your strategy. And I almost felt reading the book that there is a space for like a fifth column or whatever you call it, like, you know, like this sort of tiny little or maybe quite a big tenet that has like, you know, don't build shit that harms people on it. And I wonder whether that was your consideration when you were writing a book and you didn't include it because it just didn't fill the vision, or maybe it's something that maybe you felt wasn't appropriate at the time, or how do you, you know, what's your stance on this?
So when I wrote the first book, obviously, like everyone else, I was, you know, we glorified the successes of companies like Airbnb and Uber. And yeah, I hated Facebook way back then too, but I could talk about what they were doing that worked because they were really the company that everybody looked at for like, oh, well, Mark Zuckerberg didn't have a business model. And people think he magically went from 0 to 1, you know, or 0 to 10, you know, when he didn't. He started with basically, you know, starting in Harvard and scaling. And so, you know, it wasn't to tell the truth behind it. You know, I was on the road. I was in Canada. Quebec. I was in Quebec and I was at a conference. I think it was called Webby Quebec. And it was the first time I met Mike Montero. And I had heard of the guy. I knew he was a badass, but I didn't understand. I had never had someone come up to me at a conference and just completely attack me the second I came off the stage. And he came up to me and he said, you know, you talk about Airbnb as if it was such a good thing that what they did with innovation. But I can tell you from living in San Francisco in the Mission District that they destroyed it. Mike Montero, you know, read me the Riot Act on Airbnb. That was really the beginning of when I started thinking about ethics. And he had just kind of started pivoting his talks to be focused on ethics and writing his new book that was related, Ruined by Design, which is a great book. There was other people, you know, it affected Neriel, you know, there's a bit of a backlash and, you know, around Hooked and this whole model of addictive design. And I'm not just on the design front or the business strategy front, is I had a guy come up to me at another workshop and say there was parts of my competitive research where I had recommended at one point, not in the book, but in the workshops, like that, you know, just calling up, you know, competitors and pretending you're not, you know, their competitor, and, you know, and giving false information was actually ethically, you know, screwed up. So it really, all of those things just made me rethink, you know, what I should be advocating in the book, and that I needed to touch on that. And so as far as it being a fifth tenet, I don't think so. I think it's actually ethics comes into play with all four tenets. It comes into play with your business model when you're figuring out your business strategy, because if you're going to do something that ultimately monetizes, you know, behavior that is addictive, like, you know, insane notifications, just to have frictionless design, that's BS, you know. The whole idea of having frictionless design and making it frictionless for the purpose of building a sticky product that's just getting people stuck in there, but giving them no value, that's not okay. Value innovation should be something that isn't harmful. And then I guess the value of the user research, it's really like that's your opportunity to learn from people, you know, if you're solving the problem or just charging them money to ostensibly solve a problem that they may not even have.
Okay, no, that's a pretty good answer. I was kind of hoping that you'd say this, that it just goes throughout, and I see that obviously, naturally, this is your line of thinking too. Okay, so the final question from me. You see, many musicians that I know, when they record their albums, while they go to the recording, they already have enough material for the next album. So I have to ask you about this. I know that you know, it's been a ride to write this, but you know, have you considered, maybe, you know, or you have somewhere there in your head more ideas for something new, a new book?
No. I mean, when I finished the first one, I said I would never write a book again. But I think it's like when you get high, you're constantly chasing that first high. And I don't think I'm chasing the first high necessarily. It was more of an opportunity to update a lot of different things in the book and take my practice to the new level before I retire. But I think, you know, Wojtek, that I'm getting a little long in the tooth here. And I think it's time for some, you know, younger designers who are going to come up and have bold new ideas to write other product strategy books. I'm quite surprised that there aren't any true books on product strategy. And I doubt I'll write another book at this point. But if I do, it's got to be, I mean, this is ridiculous to say, but I've been asked to write a memoir for a real publisher, and I don't even know if I have that in me. It seems so self-indulgent. I really want to remake all my old new media stuff and the floppy disk and get my work into a museum and revisit that part of my life.
That's great. Focus more on art. Okay, Jamie, before we go, I know that you are organizing a really good set of workshops for people who would like to learn more about strategy, UX strategy. Would you like to use this opportunity to invite some folk to it?
Sure thing. So the thing with any methodology, it's one thing to read a book and quite another to actually learn the practice, which can only be achieved by spending time actually conducting the techniques, ideally in linear order. So because I've been teaching courses at different universities, I know that you can teach product strategy in a comprehensive way. And I wanted to open up my courses from the university to everybody who are actually practitioners in the field. So I reinvented the course. So it's 6 weeks long. This one is the first one I'm doing live lectures that people can attend. You can find it on the internet by keywords UX strategy masterclass, Jamie, J-A-I-M-E, Levy, L-E-V-Y. And you'll see there's 5 sections starting May 24th, May 25th. And if you sign up, he'll graduate with a portfolio and a certification at the end, but certainly the knowledge of how to de-risk value props, do competitive research, do online user research, understand the concepts of smoke tests through landing pages, and so forth.
In a real proper punk style, because we take no prisoners, don't we?
Definitely.
Right. Thank you, Jamie, for your time and for writing this wonderful book. Take care.
Thank you. Bye, everybody.
So, this was Jamie Levy. I hope you enjoyed that. Stay in tune with UX Booster, and more stuff will come your way. See ya!